Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs. This is episode 720, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from the website Kirkham A Movie A Day. This week brings one of our favorite formats back for another round. This is the What You've Been Watching episode. The reason this is a great exercise for us is that it requires little advanced preparation and a whole bunch of self-disclosure. All that's required is for our guests to tell us about a few movies that they've watched in the recent past. I do provide a few boundaries, let's say that they watched it within the last month or so, and ideally that they have at least three to bring to the discussion. It doesn't matter if it's a new film or an old one, and it doesn't need to be a first-time watch, although those are always welcome too. We want to know a little bit about the title, why you chose to watch the film, a brief spoiler-free synopsis, and a recommendation about whether or not we should be looking for it as well. Also, guys, if you do recommend a film, if you have some idea about where we could find it, that would always be appreciated. This is a fun exercise because the guests tell us about their movie habits, and we learn what kind of weirdos we really have as members of the Lambcast. The first of those oddballs this week is my buddy Nick Rehack, back with us after an absence of a few months. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, thank you for having me back, Richard.
Glad to have you. Next, Nicole Ayers of the Mad Lab Post. She keeps us honest with esoteric and small releases and short films, so be prepared for anything today. Hey, Nicole.
Hey, and I'm trying to be normal and not too weird this week, so I hope that my selections don't have you guys thinking that I'm as cold as a corpse.
We also have the potential for explosive film content with Will Slater from Exploding Helicopter on the show.
No preparation, winging it off the cuff. It's like I'm taking my university exams again, Richard.
That's the way I always tried to do it, too. Finally, the second most recognizable voice you hear on the Lambcast these days, my fellow Texan and refugee from California, Howard Kasner. He's ranting and raving on pop art these days.
Hello.
Before we get started, it is the week that the Academy Awards nominations came out, and there was a little bit of controversy this week about some of the awards. There's always what people perceive to be as snubs or somebody who got nominated and they didn't see they were deserving of it, somebody who should have been nominated, and we're a little irritated about that. And I just wanted to give anybody who had an opportunity, you know, that they had something they wanted to get off their chest, an opportunity to say what their thoughts were before we get started. So I'll start this week because I don't really have a lot of complaints. I do just want to defend one thing. I know that people were a little upset about Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig being left off the lists for director and actress for their film Barbie. To me, that's not a surprise at all. I did not care for Barbie, and my point of view is that it was the worst film of the year that I saw, and the fact that it got nominated surprises me. But I understand why Greta Gerwig didn't get nominated. The meme that I've seen, of course, is that the whole Academy Awards process is, you know, Barbie in real life, you know, where Ken gets all the attention and because he's a man and all the women get slighted. I just think it's one of those cases where the director's branch is, look, you had two or three films that were clearly going to be nominated, so that narrowed down the possible selections. The director's branch is a little bit more, what should we say, snooty, exclusive, highbrow in their nature, and so even though Barbie was the most popular movie in the world last year, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to go down well with the directors. And I think that there are a lot more international influence than there used to be, and so I think that kind of explains some of the other nominations that got in there. I always look at the people who did get nominated and ask, who would you eliminate and replace with Greta Gerwig, and I'm not sure that there was anybody that jumped out for me. There are a couple of films that I haven't seen that did get nominated in this category. Howard, did you think anybody should have been excluded in order to get Greta Gerwig in?
Well, no. Even though of the movies nominated for Best Picture, three or four didn't appear on my list, I thought this was, in all categories, one of the best set of nominations in quite a long time. To be honest, anybody who's been actually following the Oscar process and the campaigns knew a month or so ago that Barbie's star was dimming. So I was surprised that Robbie wasn't nominated, but I wasn't shocked. And the same for director. And I do the same thing too. When someone says she got snubbed, well, then I ask, who do you want to replace them with? Because who do you want to snub? And I almost never get an answer. And sometimes wonder if these people have even seen the other films. I sometimes get an answer like Killers of the Flower Moon. I'm going, yeah, good luck having Greta Gerwig get a nomination over Killers. One of the things that started it waning is all of a sudden all these films like Anatomy of the Fall and The Zone of Interest suddenly started appearing, American Fiction and things like that. And Barbie just wasn't up to them. It's an entertaining film. People say like, well, I guess the Academy just doesn't like movies about women's stories or women's journeys. And I said, you mean like Anatomy of a Fall, Poor Things, Past Lives, Naiad? And they'll say, you know, Barbie was snubbed in acting. I go, you mean like America Ferrara? And I put on a post today that I wonder if it's going to be controversial. And I said the outrage over Barbie is very white privilege because no one's getting very upset that The Color Purple didn't do well. And last year, when Andrea Riseborough got the nomination over Danielle Deadwyler, the nomination for Riseborough was led by white actors. And the objection to it was mainly by black actors. So there's more going on here to this than simply the Academy is a patriarchy. It is. It is a patriarchy. And women are not treated well. The problem is this isn't an example of it. There are better examples to get. And eventually, as I said, I think there's a bit too white privilege going on here in this objection.
Anybody else have thoughts either on the Barbie issue or other elements of the nominations? I know Will doesn't care at all.
Well, all I would say is that no film featuring an exploding helicopter was nominated in the Best Picture category.
And shameful.
In the 90-odd years of the Academy Awards, no film featuring an exploding helicopter has ever won the Best Picture Academy Awards. So, I mean, you know, that should tell you everything you need to know about my position on the Academy Awards.
I like that. That's a good way of looking at it. Nicole, did you have thoughts? I'm sorry. Did we cut you off?
Well, now that you put it like that, I want to say, let's have some more exploding helicopters as an action movie lover, you know, I would love to see a movie with an exploding helicopter nominated before Greta Gerwig and possibly before Margaret Robbie. I like Howard. I was surprised that Margaret Robbie didn't receive the nomination for actress. At the same time, I'm not disappointed that she didn't. Just mostly because given the nominations, and I haven't seen all of the movies that are up for Best Picture and Actor just yet. I still need to watch Killers of the Flower Moon and a couple of other titles. And I'm a Barbie fan. So, and I still haven't seen the Barbie movie, but as anyone who's probably listened to a previous podcast, Lambcast episode, you know, that was in to boycott the Barbenheimer, the Barbenheimer theatrical release that pushed Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible out of the IMAX theaters. However, that said, I do still plan on watching it so that I can see it and see what all of the fuss is about. And I want to say kudos to Ryan Gosling for getting a nom for Best Actor. Do I think he's going to win? Probably not. But I am still happy that he got the nomination for a movie that was really, really popular, it seemed. And, you know, I think all of this whining about the Barbie movie is unnecessary. And I say that as someone who will still probably buy the Barbie movie just because I collect dolls. Like, I like Barbies in general, so I'm going to gravitate toward that. I have Barbie branded pink lemonade in my refrigerator right now, for example. So I am into the Barbie world. But when you're talking about the Academy's awards, like, Greta, really, you want her nominated for Best Director? How old is Scorsese? And how many times has he been Scorsese?
Yeah.
Can't get a Best Director win. And you think Greta is just supposed to slide in because she has a popular movie? It's not going to work that way. Anyhow, moving on, I am happy that for the Holdovers nominations, Paul Giamatti and the other Divine Joy and the other nominations that they received. I'm super, super happy for everyone. I am disappointed that Penelope Cruz didn't swing a nom for one of the actress categories. And I am disappointed that a short film titled Yellow, which was shortlisted in the best live action short category, did not make it into the nominations. I love this movie. It's beautiful, beautiful film. And, but I will, you know, I hope that it will be released, you know, still sometime this year.
Yeah, I remember you're promoting it on the show a few weeks ago. And so the fact that it didn't get nominated wasn't your fault. You did the best you could to promote it. Nick, did you have any thoughts about the Academy Awards?
My only thing was, and Howard kind of touched on it a little bit, I was really pleasantly surprised and happy to see a lot more foreign entities and foreign interests in the categories across the board, films like Past Lives, Zone of Interest, Anatomy of a Fall, things like that. I think that's great. I'm also really loving all the love for Poor Things. I think it's great to see such a hilarious and comedic film get nominated for a bunch of awards, and hopefully it wins. So, because ain't nothing wrong with more comedy at the Oscars, if you ask me.
Well, the best thing about the nominations, from my point of view, is it usually gets these movies back into theaters so that people can get an opportunity to see it where it's supposed to be seen, in the theater, as opposed to just streaming at home. I don't think Anatomy of a Fall played any place near me. It was streaming, and I do want to see it, but I know that a couple of the chains have weeks where they run all of the films in their theaters that are nominated, and you can get a special pass for that sort of thing. So I'll be doing that, catching up on some of these things. And I do appreciate the fact that Sterling K. Brown got a nomination because he was a featured character in Supernatural. And I'm always happy when somebody that I recognize from a TV show that I watch gets some recognition in the movies. Good for him. All right. Well, I think we've got enough talk on that. You know, you're always welcome, folks, to submit a post to the Lamb If you have something that you want to talk about concerning this, I don't think that Movie Rob's planning on running the Academy Awards series that he did in the past. That got quite elaborate and very complicated trying to get people to write about all 23 categories. But I wouldn't be opposed if somebody has a couple of categories that they want to talk about. If you send me those, I'll be happy to post them on the LAM site. Well, let's get out of the Academy Awards talk and talk about what people have been watching this week. Like we said, it's a real simple process that we've got here. We're just asking people what they've been catching up with lately. And Nicole, I'm going to start with you. What have you watched this last few weeks that you really think we ought to know about?
I watched a few films for the last few weeks. I think that you guys might know about at least two of them, but it's been some time since I had the opportunity or even remembered them to sit down and watch them. So I took this opportunity to check some movies off of my to watch list.
All right.
And
what's the first one you got?
One of them is the first one that I have is titled The Handmaiden that came out in 2016. I forget
Incredible
the director.
Film.
Thank
my
you,
favorite
Howard.
Film of, my favorite film of that year. It was number one.
Oh, okay. And so I, Howard, I love your thoughts on my take on this movie because I've been wanting to watch this. I remember when it came out, I think, and I just kept putting it off. And I'm like, let me just watch it. And so, you know, it's a crime drama about, you know, a Korean con man who gets help from an orphaned pickpocket to send the pickpocket woman to work as a handmaiden to a Japanese heiress. But the con man and the orphaned pickpocket woman, they are in cahoots in a plot to defraud the heiress, and they devise an elaborate plot to seduce and milk her out of her inheritance. And there are a lot of twists and turns in this movie. I was very surprised, and I'm also glad that I watched it first so that I wouldn't have any weird dreams. I watched this at night, and I found the movie to be very well done. Great acting, cinematography, music, everything works. The characters, though, really creeped me out and made me angry in that I found this to be a very cold-blooded movie with some very sick, perverted, and devious characters. But I like that it was, you know, made well, and it kept me on my toes. At one point in the movie, I actually became confused for a little bit when they had a little twist, and then the twist and turns kept coming. But I was able to get back on track by paying close attention. I found The Handmaiden to be a bit more sexually explicit than I would have liked to see. I do think that some of the sex scenes were a little longer than necessary, and that's not necessarily something that's just on The Handmaiden. I think there are a lot of movies that have sex scenes that might be too long for me. Like, when I'm watching sex scenes, like, I get the point, so I just want to move the story along and get to the next scene. And while I'm on that topic, I do want to give kudos to those movies that have very tasteful love scenes or sex scenes that don't overwhelm the viewer too much. But I also think that The Handmaiden is a good example of how you can increase or diminish the value of something solely based on how you present it. And it's a good example of how creating unique events or experiences that captivate an audience can make you unforgettable for better or worse. Now, of course, there are some, you know, times in life where, say, bookstores or as someone who's attended script readings, for example, myself, and know that there's a lot of book signings and author readings and social events happening every day, everywhere, if not all at once. I think The Handmaiden proves that imagination and creativity go a long way if you're putting on a live performance or hosting a party or an event. So I think it's visually inspiring in terms of creativity. At the same time, I think that it has some very cruel characters, unfortunately.
Well, I got to tell you, I've heard people talking about this movie. You gave a more interesting synopsis of it than I've heard. I mean, I was motivated to see it because people had high praise for it, not because I had any idea what it involved. And now I have some idea about what it involves. And I'm not saying I have to watch it for the sex scenes, but the idea that there's a con man pickpocket subplot, or maybe that's the main plot that's going on here, certainly is a lot more intriguing than what I thought was going to be the story there. So you're selling it.
Yeah, there's it. There is a lot. It is a great. I do think it's a great movie.
And I remember Howard liking it very much. Yes. Has anybody else seen the movie?
It was my favorite film of that year. Yeah.
Nick, Will?
I haven't seen it, but it being a Chan-wook Park film, it's something Park Chan-wook film, excuse me. It's something I definitely want to check out.
Good deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen it. I remember thinking it was very good, but I have to say I remember very little about the film for whatever. I mean, you know, there's so much space in my brain to sort of remember the details of the films. But I was interested about. You know, we talked about the sex scenes here, and I was interested because you were saying that you're only so interested in them, and it's definitely something that I found as I've got older. Like, I'm really like I think I just need very minimal sex scenes. I just establish that these characters are going to have sex, and you know, whatever that tells you, what you need to know about their relationship at that moment. I really don't need to. I've just sort of lost. You know, I don't need to see, thrusting buttocks and bouncing boobs anymore. Like, I don't know what, I don't know, maybe I'm...
Your testosterone level has been dropping.
It could be. Maybe my testosterone level is dropping. I mean, you know, maybe I'm revealing too much here. Maybe this is a conversation for my therapist. I mean, I really don't know. But I don't know. I just think I'm just bored. I am bored of sex scenes. They're, you know, you kind of, I don't know, maybe I've just seen sort of too many, and they're all kind of the same. Although I have to say, having said they're all kind of the same, Nick and I did watch a film recently where there was a very unique sex scene which kind of picked up on the film is all about a kind of submarine sonar operator. Mm-hmm. Who's obviously, you know, his profession is listening to things. So the sex scene is actually the focus of the sex scene is actually more auditory. So it's all on the sort of the sounds of like people breathing, of people's heartbeats, of rustling, which was, it didn't erotically charge me, but it was interesting to see a sex scene done in a different way for once.
Less skin, more eardrum.
I should perhaps put that on my dating profile.
It sounds like I have to gather some movie recommendations to send you to see if you've watched some of those. For me, I haven't. I don't think that sex scenes look the same. I think that there are some movies that are able to do them well. For me, it's both, you know, style and length. And so I think it's hard for some directors to find that happy medium. And I didn't mind the style of the sex scene in The Handmaiden. It was just the length of it. Like, I don't want to have sex with them. during I feel like sometimes.
Well, there are a whole bunch of length jokes that I'm not making while I'm sitting here talking about this. I'm trying to be a little careful.
I saw a short film, for example. There's a short, totally unrelated short Iranian film that I watched a few years ago, where for the first 10 minutes or so, it's just a scene about a guy in a bath, taking a bath, shaving. And I'm like, listen, I don't want to bathe with him. So can we just kind of trim this scene down a bit? Like, I don't have to watch him take the entire bath and shave his entire body. And that is what this guy is doing. Same thing here with The Handmaiden. I do think that it's the whole movie is like beautifully done. That said, I don't want to feel like I'm engaging in the act with these people because it's so long. I feel like I'm a part of it with them.
Well, Nick, have you got a film that doesn't require us to engage in a sex act?
I do, yes. Okay. actually, yeah, no. No, because you don't – no, this one's fine. I'll do this one then.
Okay.
I'm just thinking about the sex scene that – it kind of – there's not really a sex scene in this movie. It's called The Victim. It's from 1980. It stars Sammo Hung. It's a kung fu comedy film. Over the holidays, and it's so funny that Nicole started off with a film by Park Chan-wook. My cousin during the Christmas holidays was like, hey, man, I was at the movie theaters. Have you ever heard of Old Boy? And I was like, have I? And we just went into this whole rabbit hole, and he starts telling me about his interest in kung fu movies, and I'm like, we should get together, hang out sometime, watch some movies. So he showed me this. I've never seen it or heard of it before. It's called The Victim. And essentially, there's this guy who is just going around picking fights, and if someone can beat him in a fight, he will train under them as a master. And he happens to stumble upon a fight, breaks it up, ends up getting a beating in the process, but he devotes himself to this new master. And the guy is reluctant. He's like, get away from me. I don't want nothing to do with you. So it just becomes this like kind of odd couple-esque type thing where they're just at odds and fighting with each other the whole time. Meanwhile, his new master has a pretty serious problem. And he's on the run, and he has to stop another martial arts master that's coming after him. And it's really, really funny. A lot of really great martial arts. But there's some twists and turns in here that as they happen, it amplifies the humor but also shocks you at the same time. There was a good 3 minutes straight watching this film where like my jaw was just on the floor and I couldn't pick it back up. There is so much that happens in this film, even some of the comedy and the comedic turns that it takes. There are some beats that I found so absurd and so pointless to be like, why is this in the movie? But then it ends up working itself perfectly into the movie, and it just brought me so much joy. I've never really seen a kung fu action film outside of Kung Fu Hustle. So to see like an older film or like some of the like originals to have done it, do it, it was just such a fantastic time. It's only like, I think it's like an hour and a half, hour 40 minutes, nothing crazy. He had a DVD copy of it. I'm sure you could find it on like Amazon or somewhere like that. But it's called The Victim. It's from 1980. Do check it out because it's funny. Like, it's truly a funny film. And it's not just a like physicality slapstick kind of funny, although that is there. But it's not like the sole focus of it. There's a little more humor surrounding it as well. And it's just a good time.
It sounds like a good time. You know, I liked Kung Fu Hustle and the idea that there is an amusing way to depict this kind of combat styles, that sounds like fun. And you've described it old school. I like that idea too, you know. And the fact that it's maybe only accessible on physical media, right on.
One thing I liked about it too, and it's something that my cousin and I have been talking about more and more, is these older action films and just seeing how the camera just lets it take place. It's not like nowadays where a punch is thrown and it has to be a quick edit to something else, and then another body part goes flying and quick edits to cuts to that and cuts and cuts and cuts and cuts. It's just letting the action happen, letting it play out, and letting that be the star. And it's just really refreshing to see that. It almost feels like I'm seeing something I've never seen before, even though I've seen it time and time again as it's been harped on as the years have gone by. So it's really nice to go back and like see the origins of that stuff.
Everything old is new again.
Basically.
Will, are we getting an action film from you this week?
You're not getting an action film from me. You're getting a film from 1962 called Panic in Year Zero, which I caught up with a couple of weeks ago. And I've always been intrigued by films that are inspired by the atomic age, you know, whether they explore the sort of moral dilemmas, you know, whether those are personal, sort of political. And this is I thought this was a really interesting one because I think this one obviously came out in 1962, but sort of up to sort of this sort of point, sort of you had a lot of, you know, atomic inspired movies, sort of nuclear themed movies from the 50s. And they kind of tended to be sort of, you know, mostly these sort of big bug movies. But then in the sort of early 60s, you then sort of get some more films which are perhaps a little bit more realistic, that have kind of more grounded plot lines. You know, the story of this one is, you have like Ray Milland, who's the head of this family, who they're just setting off on this camping trip just as Los Angeles is hit by a nuclear bomb. And among the general population, there's initially lots of confusion as to what's happening. You know, telephones are not working, radio stations have gone off the air. But, you know, Milland sort of realizes or sort of kind of guesses what's happened and kind of realizes that society is going to start sort of falling apart. And he quickly goes into sort of doomsday prepper mode, and so the film then sort of follows his efforts to try and keep his family safe. He's got a wife and two teenage children. So what plays out from there is you see the sort of the breakdown in law and order as people try to compete for resources, or they use the absence of officialdom to indulge their basest instincts. You know, this was a sort of Roger Corman production, so the film's geared sort of more towards salacious incidents than it is to a sort of, you know, cold thematic exploration. But there is actually some really interesting stuff in here, and there's also some really edgy content here, particularly when it comes to tackling sexual violence here. I mean, obviously it's tempered by the codes of the day, but you know, I was very struck watching this film, you know, having watched, you know, a lot of stuff from the 50s, 60s, you kind of like, oh, actually, this is going into some sort of darker territory than you often kind of get from films of this particular era. And, you know, you can see here the types of plot lines, the types of tropes that post-apocalyptic cinema has just been using over and over again. I mean, you know, you can see variations on the plot, you know, incidents and plot lines in this film that, you know, turn up time and time again, you know, even into, I mean, it's not nuclear inspired, but I mean, you know, like even like zombie movies, like the things like The Walking Dead would, you know, they're very similar sort of incidents and storylines take place in here. So, yeah, Panic in Year Zero, I found it, like a really interesting watch. I mean, later films have done this stuff better. But I always think it's interesting to go back and see early efforts, you know, the kind of like the building blocks of tropes and genres, you know, being put in place. And I found Panic in Year Zero a very interesting watch because it, you know, provides a sort of snapshot into the sort of mindset of the culture at a particular moment in time. So, yeah, I really enjoyed my time with Panic in Year Zero.
I remember seeing this on local television, probably the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, I was a very young person at the time, you know, maybe 9 or 10, and being creeped out by the very idea. You know, it's probably, like you said, like a zombie kind of thing, but it's about the power and the, you know, the absence of any order and a sense that there is a society that's going to continue to exist. My memory of it is vague. I did remember that Ray Milland was in it, and they were on a camping trip, and that they come across, I don't think it was a biker gang, but it was, you know, a group of young thugs at some point.
Exactly right.
And it was, you know, it was disturbing to me at the time. I haven't seen it in 55 years, I guess. So.
But yeah, it's stuck in your brain.
Yeah, it did. It did. You know, and your talk about it makes me want to go back and recheck it out. You know, that sounds like it'd be a fun watch. Not maybe a fun watch, but an interesting one.
No, it's a fun watch.
Okay, good.
It's the thing that strikes you is it's so much better than it has any right to be. The acting is rather good. The directing, which is Ray Milland directed it as well, is very solid. So it's not a great film, but it's very entertaining. It does what it does much better than many other films do. So I can agree. I can recommend it.
All right. Well, what are you going to recommend that you watched yourself this week or last week or the week before that?
Well, I think I'm doing what I did the last time, which is a movie from three different streaming services.
Okay.
And the first one I got from Mubi, and it's called The Green Perfume. It's from 2022. It's a French film. An actor is poisoned and dies on stage in the middle of a performance. His dying words are whispered to Martin, a member of the troupe and a friend of the victim, and the words are green perfume. Martin then becomes a primary suspect while being chased by a mysterious organization named the Green Perfume. This is an attempt at doing an Alfred Hitchcock movie. In fact, it unashamedly seems to steal from North and Northwest, left and right. It's enjoyable. It's entertaining. I kept with it. It's not as good as Hitchcock, and I think mainly because Hitchcock has all these set pieces. And this was just did what it did and didn't really try to do any more. But it was actually quite fun.
Is there anybody that we would recognize in it?
No, to be honest, I hate to sound snobby, but I recognize some people. So only people who are really into French films.
I gotcha.
The lead actress would be very recognizable because she's done a number of French films that have gotten real big. The others, you may have seen them, you may have not, but they're not big names. At least over here, they're not big names.
Okay. And you saw it on Mubi?
Mubi, okay. Yeah.
Well, that sounds interesting. You know, something that we could be thinking about, and you would recommend it.
Yeah, I think so. I think you'd all enjoy it. It's, you know, it's yeah, I think it's just fun.
All right. Well, my first film is Exercise in Nostalgia. It was something that I saw when I was in college. I think I actually saw it at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood, which would be a strange location to see it at because it's not a big film. It doesn't require a wide screen. It's not exactly something that you would think people would line up for. Somebody probably had a reason for doing it. It's The Chicken Chronicles from 1977, which is basically just a high school sex comedy. It's notable only for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the debut film of Steve Guttenberg. So all you Steve Guttenberg completists out there, if you are interested in seeing his entire oeuvre, you need to make sure that check out The Chicken Chronicles. He's actually pretty good in it. It's like I said, it's not really very sophisticated. It's kids in high school. Mostly they are seniors, and they are interested in hooking up with the girls of their dreams. And you know, the thing that stands in their way is sometimes not having a place to connect with somebody. You know, the girlfriend that he has is nervous about any place that they go, so he's looking for a location that they can kind of connect in. And there's a chase scene with the cops trying to track down people who were supposedly in the house, and he thinks they think they're peepers, and that doesn't really do anything. The thing that's interesting about it is that he works at a chicken restaurant, you know, like a Colonel Sanders type place, only it's a standalone place, and the owner operator is played by Phil Silvers, who's kind of he's a slightly obnoxious boss who's very demanding, and of course the people working there you would not want to eat there if you saw the way they operate in the kitchen. In the long run, Phil Silvers kind of plays a little bit more sympathetic character. He comes to his employee's aid at one point, and that's kind of interesting. It also has Ed Lauder in it, who's one of my favorite character actors. He shows up in it as the principal of the school. John Grease, who's been in a lot of things over the years, he's not a big movie star, but he's somebody you might recognize. He's the reclusive genius in Real Genius. He's in this film also as one of the kids. Is it a great film? No. Is it funny? Occasionally. But I just remember seeing it when I was in college and thinking, well, that was kind of fun, and I hadn't seen it for 50 years or so. So when I saw it available to buy on some website, I said, okay. And I splurged and bought the DVD and checked it out. It was perfectly fine. Nothing overwhelming, but typical of the kind of crap that I would watch on a regular basis.
Well, this film looks – I just looked this film up, and it looks like it would be great to sort of remember this film just from – if you're ever playing sort of Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon, because – Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon, because the idea of Phil Silvers, Steve Guttenberg, and then there's Branscombe Richmond in the cast. Now, he might not be a name many people are familiar with, but he turned up in a ton of, like, PM Entertainment action films in the 90s. I mean, the film is a very – a nexus point. It's an overlap between some very random people, and it seems like it would be very useful to remember if you're ever engaged in a game of that. And I see it's written by the son of Billy Wilder's old writing
Diamond,
partner. It's written by his son, so yeah, it's interesting. Some interesting credits all over the show in this.
Yeah, thing. Frank Simon, who is the director of it, I think this is the only mainstream film he directed. He mostly did documentaries, too. So it's just kind of those one of those odd films. Somebody got some money and said, let's make this movie. And I don't know that it was a success. Like I said, it just seemed odd to me that I saw it. It was probably playing for 1 week at the Cinerama Dome in 1977. And that might have been the main reason I went to see it, because it was at one of those theaters that I like to go to. All right, we're back around to Nicole. Nicole, you got something else for us, huh?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I have the second film that was on my to-watch list that I've been wanting to see for a few years now, and I've always skipped it for some odd reason, and I pulled the plug this time, or shall I say, I took the leap in watching the sci-fi action drama Ready Player One.
Ah, all right.
And just like Handmaiden, this was my first watch, my first time seeing this movie, and I was very entertained. It was quite the adventure, and there were moments where I screamed out loud while watching this movie, and I was pleasantly surprised at that, because I'm not a huge gamer, but I guess with all the action and drama and comedy going on, there were one or two times where I had jumped and I'm like, oh fuck, like I got really into the movie. And so it was really, really entertaining. I'm so happy. I'm like smiling just thinking about it and talking about it. I love it. So I take it you all are familiar with Ready Player One.
I think we did it as a show when it came out. I think that was one of our featured films that we talked about, because it was a big deal. The book was very popular, especially among the gaming community, and it's a Steven Spielberg film. It's set in the sci-fi world, And as I recall, the main reason that everybody who did like it liked it is because it's just one Easter egg after another. You know, some reference to some 80s film or some game that people play. Characters show up all over the place. I remember that everybody was very enthusiastic about the Shining sequence.
That's where I looked away. Yeah, that's one point because I'm not like a huge horror fan. I looked away, like after there's a scene where those girls, the twins, mm-hmm. there's like a creepy scene, and because I still haven't built up enough courage yet to watch The Shining, I do want to watch it. But I'm just not there right now. But that was the part of the movie where I looked away a bit, and then I would look back like, is this over? No? Okay.
It's still going
zombies?
On.
Zombies now? All right. Fine. I was happy to see Chucky in this movie.
I mean, I found this film, there's a lot going on in it. I mean, it's rich in sort of like flashing visuals and you know, sort of sensory stimulation, but I was left just feeling this film just ultimately felt a bit empty, a bit hollow, a bit soulless for me. I wasn't particularly enamored by this particular film, and I for me, definite sort of B, C level Spielberg for me, I'm afraid to say.
Well, I don't think that that's too far off from the way a lot of people felt about it, that they saw it, that it got made. They were happy about that, that it's essential or something that was compelling. Not so much. You know, it felt pretty derivative. I only saw it the one time, you know, and that's rare for me to say. I've seen a Spielberg film one time. Usually I've seen them multiple times, and I never felt a need to go back. I've come across it several times in the bargain bin at Walmart or at Target and passed it by because I didn't feel it was necessary to add to my collection. But that doesn't mean that it isn't fun to watch when you were watching it.
Yes, it was. It's like, I guess maybe player one is like, you know, a popular ride at an amusement park. You know, you want to get on it, and when you get on it, it's a fun ride. And, you know, and then afterward, you know, you're not, there's no need to be compelled about it, but it's like you did it, and it was
enjoyable whilst you were riding.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, and you,
but let's
you
find
know
the next
that
thing.
You can have a good time.
Nick, what's your second film this week?
My second film is, I don't remember what compelled me to watch it, but I found it on Amazon and I did. It's called The Great Silence. It's a 1968 Western, and essentially there's this gunfighter who's a mute, and he's defending a young lady and a group of outlaws against a bunch of bounty killers that are coming to like this small little camp slash town area. It's really tense. It's really slow. It's a film where it takes a little bit to really get going. And if you're not like fully invested by like the 30-minute mark, then you probably won't enjoy it. But it's one of those films where it's just such strong characters. Like the acting is really, really good. Even though the script may have some issues at times, and the film goes to places that you don't expect, but that also leaves you wondering, like, oh no, did I like this? Did I not like this? It's a little out of the ordinary, especially for a Western, especially for something out of like, you know, the 60s. It's an Italian. I wouldn't say it's not really a spaghetti Western, but it like kind of is at the same time.
Directed by the second greatest director of spaghetti Westerns ever.
Yeah.
Sergio Corbucci.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know a lot about Corbucci. I've always just been a, why can't I think of his name off the top of my head? Leone,
yeah.
Kind of guy. And so stumbling across this, I definitely want to check out the guy's other films that he's done. unless I think I already have. I think
you've
I might
see,
have.
You've got to see Django, that's for sure.
I did see Django, so I'm thinking, all right, so there's at least two films. But with The Great Silence, I don't know, it just felt so different. And I think it's because it was primarily in the snow, which you don't see a whole lot of. And it was just something about the acting. I ended up buying it, and I have a copy of it. I want to watch it and watch it again. But there's something about the movie that just draws me to it, even if there's some moments where I'm like, I don't know if I like this or not. It's really weird and complex. It's a hard feeling to describe.
I think I know that feeling, Nick. I think I know that feeling. I can think of films that I've watched in the past that sort of like, you know, I've been a bit lukewarm on them, but they've sort of stayed, they've lingered in my mind somewhere, and I've then been sort of drawn back, and then start watching the film again, and you start sort of seeing, oh yeah, you know what, this is, you know, there's some other stuff here, and then you watch it again, you're like, god damn, this is amazing, and then, you know, you watch it again, you're like, this is a masterpiece.
Well, it might happen with this one, because, like I said, pacing's pretty decent. It's only an hour 45, so if you have a chance to catch it, I would, but don't put it at like the top of your list to immediately rush out and see it.
All right, so when we get the opportunity and we've got a leisurely hour and 45 minutes, give it some attention. But
yeah,
you know, don't stay up late.
No, don't watch this at night, because you might fall asleep. So it's quiet, because the guy's a mute, so there's not a whole lot of dialogue coming out of him.
Will, you've seen The Great Silence. What else have you seen?
I haven't actually seen The Great Silence. I have heard of it, and it is a film that I sort of want to tick off my list at some point, but more keen, sort of increasingly keen to do that after hearing Nick's praise for this film. But in terms of my next film, the one I saw a film from 1960 called Private Property. The story here, we're introduced at the beginning of the film to like two drifters. It's probably the best word I can use to describe them, played by Corey Allen and Warren Oates, who I think is making his screen debut in this film. We quickly sort of learn that these guys are like, they're aimless, they're amoral. Alan's character is clearly the leader. Oates is this more sort of naive, inexperienced sort of sidekick type character. There's a curious sort of ambiguous relationship between the two. We learn that Warren Oates' character has never slept with a woman, and sort of Corey Allen's character has like promised to set him up with like a woman so that he can like finally get laid. But there's more than a whiff of sort of homosexuality about Warren Oates' character, and perhaps about the relationship between these two guys. They end up breaking into a house opposite the home of a couple. The husband's a salesman who is almost comically uninterested in his wife Anne, who is this sexually frustrated blonde bombshell. So Alan and Oates then start inveigling themselves into sort of Anne's life, ostensibly on the basis of getting Oates laid, but it seems that sort of, you know, the Corey Allen's character has his own ideas here. What plays out from there is this sort of psychological sexual drama that feels for 1960 like very edgy, very boundary pushing. And I recently rewatched Peeping Tom, which came out the same year, the Powell and Pressburger film. I mean, they're very different films, but you know, you could. I was sort of struck in my mind by a parallel between the two, in the sense that both of them were sort of pushing against the sort of social mores of the day. Now apparently this film was sort of an independent production that sort of fell into obscurity, and that was sort of re-released and sort of rediscovered back in 2016 when it seemed to have some sort of re-release. Seemed to be in cinemas as well. I don't quite know how that came to be, but certainly had a physical media release at that time. But this film, you know, feels, having watched it, feels very much like a forerunner of films that would come out in the later 60s and the 70s. There's some very striking cinematography within this films. I mean, it got a lot of rave reviews that I've read of this film. I have to say, I didn't love it on this first watch, but it has stuck in my mind enough that I thought, you know what, I'm gonna, of all the films I've seen sort of, you know, over the last month, I'm gonna mention this one. And even though I didn't love it, I'm definitely gonna watch it again at some point, because I you know, going back to that point, you know, I was just talking about with Nick there, I wonder if this is a film that I might, on a second watch, start sort of seeing some more stuff in there, and it might kind of go up in my estimation. Wouldn't be the first time that a film has taken a couple of viewings before it reveals its full qualities to me. But yeah, Private Property, I found it a very interesting watch, with some interesting things going on then. And I would recommend it to people.
It apparently also has Jerome Crowan in it, or Cowan, who, for movie nuts, is Miles Archer in Cheesewalker.
Wow. Well, I mean, there are some. It does have some interesting. I mean, there are some people in this film who didn't have any kind of movie careers, because it was very low budget. Like, it was the director, Leslie Stevens. I mean, it was filmed in his house. You know, his kind of, his wife at the time is playing the kind of the female, the main female character in this film. But you've got some interesting talent in this film. So, like, as I said, the cinematography of this film is very striking, and the cinematographer on it is a guy, Ted McCord, who, you know, what an incredible movie career he had, going all the way back to the silent movies, and then, you know, worked on things like Treasure of Sierra Madre, Sound of Music, and you know, the camera operator in this film is Conrad Hall, who obviously went on to have a huge and very illustrious, you know, career. So there's some interesting talent involved in here, and then there's some, you know, people who are just obviously were just around and available at the time. So a weird, you know, kind of classic independent production in that way.
Well, it looks interesting. It's it's almost like a Roger Corman type film. Low budget, a couple of thugs involved in, you know, not quite terrorizing people, but playing some kind of psychosexual games. You know, that kind of thing. And I'm a Warren Oates fan, so I think that would be something that I would spend some time on.
Oh, if you're a Warren Oates fan, then you definitely need to check this out, because I think it's his debut, and it is an interesting film. He's got an interesting role. So, yeah, if you're a Warren Oates fan, then I think you definitely need to check this out at some point.
Okay, I'm going to have to work on it. Where did you see it, by the way?
I saw it on television here in the UK. We have a great channel here called Talking Pictures, which is I don't want to take this podcast off on a segue here, but very interesting channel, which basically is dedicated to showing old movies. It's a completely independent channel run by a guy who's just basically bought up old film libraries, it's a great place to see older films that don't get shown really on the major streamers, don't get shown, frankly, on UK's main domestic broadcasters. So yeah, that's where I got to see the film. So if you're in the UK, it'll probably be on again at some point in the next few months on that channel, whilst they've got the rights to show this one.
I'll have to dig around. There's got to be a place I can find it.
I think I looked it up. I think it's on Tubi.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be easy then.
So there you go. No excuses, Richard.
I have no excuse then, because I am a Warren Oates fan. I access to Tubi. You know, if I have more than 2 hours before the game starts today, I'll probably watch it. Howard, what else have you got for us?
Well, next I go to the Criterion Channel, and like once or twice a month, sometimes three times a month, they have world premieres, films that at least didn't get distributed much or didn't get distributed at all in the U.S. So this one is called Plan 75. It's from 2022. It's a Japanese film directed by Chi Hayakawa. It takes place sort of in the near future, though it's also been described as an alternate alternate reality. And the older population of Japan is not keeping up with the younger generation. They're outpacing it. There are just too many older people for the economy. You know, there's no way to take care of them, et cetera, et cetera. So they've started this thing called Plan 75. And basically, it's free euthanasia services to all Japanese citizens 75 and older. It's sort of like Soylent Green, but without the Soylent Green. It's a very different type of movie, but it's sort of like that. And it follows three people, an older woman who is trying to decide whether to use the program, a young man who is in sales and customer relations for the plan, and an immigrant who gets a job at one of the locations where the euthanasia takes place. It was Japan's entry in the 95th Academy Award for Best International Film, but it wasn't one of the ones selected. And this was the year of All Quiet on the Western Front. It's very quiet. It's not, you know, a big kind of sci-fi film. It's mainly character driven by these three people. It's low key, which for me made it all the more emotional and powerful.
Well, I think the fact that the population in Japan is aging and this movie focuses on a younger generation makes the term youth in Asia very appropriate.
No, that was a good one, Richard. I'll give you that.
Interesting. And I have Criterion, so I can look for that. Do you remember how long it is, Howard?
No, it's probably I don't think it's a particularly overwrought. It could be 2 hours.
Okay. Yeah, it's always a time commitment when I'm looking at things, because I think if it's going more than 2 hours, I'm going to have to make space for it. If it's something that's under 2 hours, I can plug it in into a lot of places in my day. So
it's an hour and 53 minutes, and I did watch it over two nights because I'm sort of getting like you. It's very hard for me to watch a film in one sitting if I'm not in the theater.
Yep, that's the way it works sometimes, I gotta say. Well, you know, because I'm not that busy. Well, I'm busy, but I'm not that busy. But there's always something going on. The dog wants my attention. We're getting ready to have lunch. Delivery's coming, and I'm going, I should be in the theater. That's because then I don't have any of those distractions. Well, my next film is full of distractions, and if there's anybody here who hasn't seen it, I'm going to be amazed, because it's one of those go-tos. It's probably maybe the seminal film for comedy in the last four decades. It's Airplane. And my reason for watching it is real simple. I bought a book that I came across. Surely You Must Be Joking, or Surely You're Not Serious is the name of the book, I think. And I read the book. It's 350 pages of Abraham Zucker memories about their careers and how they came to make this movie and become directors and comedy writers. And it talks a little bit about Kentucky Fried Theater and their earlier films. But most of it is really about the story of making the movie Airplane, which is hysterical. And it's always been funny. It's always been entertaining. And they kind of explain why it works in comparison to some other films that use the same sort of style. You know, they joke. But this film seems to work in places where other films that have that same style don't work. And in large part, it's because they adapted another movie. They basically took the plot of another film, added their own bits of business to it, and turned it into something a little bit different, which is similar to what they were doing with the Kentucky Fried Theater. And like I said, their background is they were college students in Wisconsin that were interested in comedy, and they didn't know what they were doing. It's amazing that this kind of stuff happens to people, that their lives end up this way because they have a vision, a goal, something that drives them, that keeps them going. And there's a lot of detail in the book about how the movie got made. And of course, the movie is fun. So as soon as I finished the book, I said, well, I got to watch the movie again, because I'm reading about all of those jokes that they did in the movie. I said, yeah, I got to see that. I got to see that. I got to look at these actors and the roles that they're doing in the film, and I need to appreciate it. The only thing that was missing from the book that I don't understand is how they ended up to get Howard Jarvis to be a part of the film. They don't even talk about it in the book, and to me, that's one of my favorite little bits of business. And those of you who are not familiar, Howard Jarvis is the character who gets in the taxi when Robert Hayes' character is arriving at the airport, and he turns on the meter, and at the end of the film, he's still sitting there in the taxi while the meter's running. He says, well, I'm going to give him 20 more minutes. You know? And those of you who don't know, Howard Jarvis was the tax crusader in the 1970s who got through Proposition 13 in California, and it was really about how much money was being spent in a way to kind of rein in the overspending and taxation that was going on. And it's funny because it's him who's putting up with this. And, you know, unless you have some context for that, that joke doesn't hit quite as well as it could. And I was kind of wondering how they managed to get him to be a part of the film. They talked about everybody else that they got into the movie, including their mothers, who all have small parts in the film. But they didn't mention that. But other than that, the movie is great, of course, and I'm sure that everybody here has seen Airplane.
I'm going to see it now.
Have you seen Zero Hour?
I haven't, and that's I went to look for it, and it's available for rent. I was thinking I had it available on one of my streaming services. I'm going to have to look.
Well, one of the last times I saw the film completely, because I'll often just watch portions of it, because it's the kind of film that you can pick it up in the middle. Mm-hmm. They showed it with Zero Hour, and it is just amazing how much the hues of Zero Hour, especially some of those lines.
Well, they bought the rights to the movie so that they could make Airplane.
It's just fun seeing how they took this overripe melodrama and turned it into this absolutely hysterical film using many of the same elements of the original.
All those fans of, you know, Mystery Science Theater, where the dialogue of a movie gets changed, that's kind of the basis for this film. You know, they just took Zero Hour and plugged in the things that they would have said to make it funny. All right, Nicole, I can't believe you haven't seen Airplane. It's hard for me to fathom the world where somebody hasn't seen this movie. But that's okay. What have you seen?
It doesn't sound familiar. When I look it up, then I'll find out if I saw it or not. It might be a movie that I forgot I saw. I have a lot. There are a lot of those. But for some odd reason, I thought about, when I think of Airplanes, I think Con Air with Nick Cage. And I know that that's not the movie. No. So
just a little
that's
bit.
That's a comedy, though, isn't it?
Some parts, definitely.
Yeah. What I did see next is a coming-of-age comedy drama, also based on a book called Blue Like Jazz. Have any of you heard of that?
I have not.
Okay. So neither have I. So I watched this movie actually recently this week. I streamed it after looking for another book by an author named Donald Miller that I heard about on a podcast called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years, How I Learned to Live a Better Story. So as the story goes, he wrote that book after falling into a deep depression following the release of his best-selling previous book titled Blue Like Jazz, which his agents or someone wanted him to make into a movie. And so they got investors for it, I think, and funding fell. Basically, he wrote on his blog that the movie won't be made because there's no funding for it. So two fans of his book, Blue Like Jazz, put up a Kickstarter campaign and raised like production funds for the movie, I think in 2010. Then they made the movie in 2012. It came out. And as a just quick side note, the end credits of this movie, it looks like it features all of those Kickstarter names. Like contributors in like a double screened end credit scene that I don't think I've seen before. If you took the end credits of two movies and kind of spliced them together on the left and right side of the screen, that's what the credits look like, except for the fact that the right side is all just associate producers, and they're all in alphabetical order. And then the left side is just like your regular end credits. That was interesting. But I didn't read the book, but I figured I'd watch this this movie just out of curiosity. So it's Blue Like Jazz is about a sheltered 19-year-old college student named Don who lives in Texas with his very strict Christian single mother, and he's also an active member of his church. But when he learns that his mom is having what we'll just call an entanglement right now with the youth pastor, Don hits the road in hopes of finding himself among the free-spirited and artistic student body at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, which is a school that his secular father, who happens to also love jazz music, pulled some strings to get him in. And when he gets to the school, he's welcomed by a fellow dressed up as the Pope. And the first words out of his mouth are, "Greetings, Virgin," while he hands Don a stack of condoms. And he also befriends a cynical, wise lesbian named Lauren and falls in love with the cute blonde activist named Penny. Over the course of a year, Don tries a lot of extracurricular activities, from building tall bikes to Malaysian cocktail tennis. That is a credit that is like a what do you call those? Like, it's a college like program that you can get a credit for if you participate. He tries to sign up for football, but they don't have that on camp. They canceled that because there wasn't enough interest in football. But it's not until the school's year-end blowout party one year that an unexpected ceremony helps him find himself, or find his niche, if you will. And so this movie I found to be okay. I would recommend it if you're bored, or if you're into books, and if you're, you know, if you're interested in checking out the book, or just kind of if you're familiar with the author Donald Miller and just wanted to check out like more of his work, this movie might be good. It's described as like a semi autobiographical movie about his life. The author's Christian. I found the movie to be funny in some parts. There's a robot invasion that made me laugh, and there's also a live reading in a bookstore that's one of the driest things ever. And the audience, although it's much larger than the audience in The Handmaiden, for example, most of the people at this live reading are not engaged at all. And I think that the bookstore owners in Blue Like Jazz could stand to benefit from watching The Handmaiden to get some tips. But throughout the first act of the movie, I felt like it could be a good fit for like the Lifetime Channel or an after school special, because it was really heavy handed. I felt with on on just religious tropes and the battle between like free will and or individualism versus evangelical like indoctrination. And the acting was a bit rough at first. Thankfully, the plot and the acting picked up around a quarter to a halfway through the film, and I was able to get a little more invested with it throughout the rest of the way. I am curious to find out. I've never been to Portland, but do they not use umbrellas in Portland? In Portland, because that seems to be the case in this movie, but it was okay. It made me laugh, and I first thought that it forced liberalism, both liberalism and religion, onto the viewer, but then it kind of it created a nice balance over time. So I was able. If you're able to get through like the first act, then
okay,
then it's okay.
Well, I usually sit through the credits of a movie. I'm going to predict that if I ever see this movie, I will not be watching all the credits. Because, you know, if I was one of those Kickstarter contributors, I would definitely be watching all the credits because I'd want to see my name up on the screen. But I'm not, and so I don't really have a need to see that long list. I remember seeing when the extended editions of the Lord of the Rings films played, they put in the names of everybody who was in the One Ring group that had made some kind of contribution to getting these things done. And that was like an extra 20 minutes for the credits. And I'm going, yeah, I appreciate that. Good luck for you guys. I'm not doing that. But the movie sounds like it might be interesting. And Portland is a weird place. I haven't been there for 40 years, so I couldn't tell you what it's like now and whether or not people use umbrellas. Nick, do you use an umbrella?
I don't. I have a hat.
Yeah, that's what hats are for people who don't want to carry an umbrella.
Okay, now I know, because that was a line from the movie. There's a scene, like, it rains a lot in this movie, and the main character is walking around with the umbrella, and someone says to him, "Nice umbrella," and then Penny, the girl he has a crush on, says, you know, like, something like, people don't use umbrellas in Portland.
I'm sure it's not hip, you know. You just live with the water coming down on your head. Nick, what's your next movie, your last movie for our show today?
Last movie for the show today was a rewatch for me, and that was Batman Returns. I have a coworker, and every Monday morning at about 8:30 when he gets in, he immediately comes and finds me and just starts talking to me about what he's been watching lately or just films in general. And a couple weeks ago, as the holidays were wrapping up, he was like, "Hey, man, you know Batman Returns is like a serious Christmas movie?" And I thought it was one of these, like, you know, Die Hard's a Christmas movie kind of things. And I was getting ready to have, like, a debate and be, you know, a little dickish about it. But he was talking to me about it. And I'm like, all right, you know what, let me watch it and see what's up, because I haven't watched it in forever. I'm not a real big Tim Burton kind of guy. But when I rewatched it, I don't know what it was, but I immediately fell in love with this movie. I have seen it like once or twice, maybe three times, but on a more recent rewatch, I thought it was so great. I thought it was just visually, it was fantastic. It was well acted. The story was, it was dark. I was like, this is not a Batman movie. Like, this is nuts. If you think the Nolan films are gritty and everything, no, you got to see Batman Returns, because that is truly dark. They just want to kidnap kids. They want to do all kind of crazy stuff. There is a lot of Christmas featured in the film, so it might not – it would be a little bit weird watching it, I'm sure. Yeah, it's still winter, and while it's cold, yeah, that might bring up some Christmas feelings, I guess, and the overall snow aspect of it. But – It's also not so overwhelmingly Christmas. It's just enough Christmas decoration, one or two throwaway lines, and it works out really well. But Danny DeVito is fantastic in this. I forgot that Christopher Walken was in this movie. Like, it's just stellar all around for a Batman movie. So if you're thinking about watching something Batman-related, you don't even need to see the first one. Everybody knows who Batman is at this point. Just go check out this, and I'm fairly certain it's on HBO Max right now. I think that's how I watched it. I can't remember. But I just remember really, really digging it and being really just kind of surprised at the film for what it is. And I think it's also maybe it's been so long since I've seen it. I guarantee I haven't seen this since before, like Iron Man and the rise of Marvel and all their films. So maybe going back to something like this, because this is a film out of 92, and seeing how much has changed in the superhero landscape since this film, seeing it was just like an absolute treat. So if you get a chance to see it, go see it. And if you're like, I don't know, give it a second shot, because I think it'll surprise you.
It was Christmas movie of the month on the Lambcast, I don't know, 6 years ago, give or take. It won the poll, and we covered it on that show. I'm going to see if I can find a link to put in the notes here, so with it, when people are perusing, if they want a chance to go back and listen to that discussion, they can do so. But it's a very interesting movie, and you'd think it gets a little. I think the problem is that I have with it is not this particular film, but it sets up the notion that the more villains you have, the better off the movie is going to be, and then the Schumacher follows up doing the same kind of thing and oversaturating the films, turning them into not cartoons, not comics, but I don't know, some kind of slapstick sort of thing. But this, I think, worked really well, and you've got a good combination of the main stars, Michael Keaton, Michelle Pfeiffer, Danny DeVito, and then you throw in Christopher Walken on top of that, and you're going, why wouldn't I enjoy this movie? It's got all those things that I like.
I really liked this movie. It does have a lot of detractors out there, but I really enjoy this movie. I mean, I'm not a superhero buff. I'm not a Batman aficionado, so I've got no. I'm not bringing any sort of previous to this film, which I'm sort of like, it's betraying the comics or anything. I mean, I'm not. I'm just watching it purely as a film, and I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was a lot of fun. It also has linking into one of the other films that we talked about earlier. Branscombe Richmond is in Batman Returns, and the star alongside of Steve Guttenberg in the Chicken Chronicles, as previously mentioned. So again, remembering this film for when the next time I play, six degrees again, maybe.
Do flying umbrellas count as helicopters?
Are they if they're twizzled vigorously enough? Richard, we might have to have a debate.
I don't remember if it explodes, but I do remember that we do get a twirling umbrella that's supposed to work like a helicopter that is used by the Penguin.
Well, I mean, obviously, Da Vinci's original sort of helicopter sort of design was very much along those lines. So, I mean, you've got the basis of a potentially compelling argument there, Richard.
Offshoot, Will, the exploding ornithopter.
There you go.
We've got Dune 2 coming out soon, so maybe
I thought about that earlier. All right, Will, what have you got for us to finish off?
Sure. So my last film that I'm going to be mentioning is it was a rewatch for me. So it was The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, and this is a film that I've seen many times, but I realized I hadn't actually seen it for at least 10 years. I mean, I think it could even be longer than that. Anyway, but on this rewatch, I was reminded of two things. Firstly, what a great film this is, but secondly, what a really bizarre film it is, and bizarre in the sense of just like the mystery of what on earth it is trying to say. I mean, if you're not familiar with this film, it's by Paolo Pressburger, that great filmmaking double act behind like Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, many other classics of British cinema. The story is very complicated, so I'm just going to be very broad brush, like, so it sort of across the course of this film, which spans about four decades in time. We follow this character called Clive Candy, who is a career army officer. We follow him through the Boer War, the First World War, into the Second World War. I mean, during this time, he has an on-off friendship with a German army officer played by Anton Walbrook. Obviously, at various times, their relationship is in conflict, both literally and figuratively, because they are on opposite sides of the wars that are being fought by these countries. They're also in conflict because they are in love with the same woman, a woman who also mysteriously keeps reappearing in Clive Candy's life, which, you know, for the sake of brevity, we're not going to get into that element here. I mean, it's a wonderful film. At times it's very funny. At times it's very moving. It's a war film. It's a romance. As I mentioned, though, like, the mystery is really, what is the point of this film? I mean, the central character here, I mean, the kind of mystery really revolves around the central character, which is, you know, Clive Candy. And he's portrayed in this film as the embodiment of certain sort of traditional British values, values which over the course of the film, like, are made to appear as if they are increasingly outdated, as if they are potentially endangering Britain's future. They're endangering Britain's, like, sort of prospects of winning the Second World War. But also in the film, but also the film kind of does as much to portray those values as sort of ones that are, like, quintessentially British, that ones that actually should endure, that are humanizing ones. And ultimately, it ends up being really hard to kind of work out if this film is a condemnation of those virtues and values, or if it's meant to be some sort of celebration of them. I mean, you know, the film was controversial when it was released. It was very heavily criticized in the UK because of the sort of, you know, this idea that it was being critical of these sort of particular sort of British values. And I understand its distribution in the United States, for instance, was blocked because, you know, people thought that it would be damaging to America's perception of Britain at this time when the two countries are engaged in this global conflict. And yeah, it is, as I say, it is an amazing film, a film that I really love. I do love, you know, but it's also a film that watching it again, I was just like, okay, what really is this film trying to say? And I'm probably going to, continue watching this film periodically over the rest of my life. And I'm probably periodically going to, continue to wonder as to what this film, what the message behind this film really is. I mean, I'm not unique. I think it's a very, from what I understand, it's a very common point of debate as to sort of what the sort of the ultimate meaning of this film is. And but it's a mystery that I am very happy to engage with, again and again, because there are just so many wonderful moments within this film, in terms of the acting, in terms of the fantastic visualization, the structure of this film. It's an incredible film. And if you haven't watched it, I would really give this my highest possible recommendation.
Very good, because I haven't watched it, and I'm looking for high recommendations. I'm trying to close off a lot of those blind spots. I've heard of it over the years and just neglected it. And now I don't need to neglect it anymore. I need to put it on my list and say, do it now. Howard, what have you got to finish off the show this week?
Well, this time I went to YouTube, where you find some very unusual films. And this was a revisit. I've seen this maybe twice before. And it's one of my favorite Vincent Price horror films, The Abominable Dr. Fibes from 1971. It stars Vincent Price and Joseph Cotten. And a group of medical professionals are being killed off one by one in accordance with the biblical plagues of Egypt. And the question is, who is doing it and why? It is camp of the highest order, but it's supposed to be. I mean, camp is intentionally, and it's intentional. It's intentional, and it's highly entertaining, with some of the greatest Art Deco sets you'll ever find and some great costuming. It's just one of these where, like Seven or And Then There Were None or Theater of Blood, where people are being killed off one by one in accordance with something, you know, with the, like in Theater of Blood, it's deaths in Shakespeare, and Seven, it's the seven deadly sins, etc. But it's just so ridiculously over the top and so entertaining.
Oh, you know, we talked about it on the Lambcast back in October, I think, when we were doing our scary film Lollapalooza type thing. You know, I think it came up. I think that's the show that I watched it for. But you're right. It's it is campy. It is fun. There's a sequel to it, and Theater of Blood came out about the same time. And I remember as we were watching it, my daughter asked me, she said, did he just make the same movie over and over and over again in the 70s? Because it's really the same kind of thing. You know, somebody's got a vendetta that they're doing to kill a bunch of other people and trying to do it in interesting ways. And it's fun.
I haven't seen this film, but I am familiar with the director, Robert Fust or Fuest. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his surname. He's done a couple of films that I've watched. So he did another. I mean, if you like sort of things that are definitely in the camp range, then he was the guy who helmed Devil's Reign from 1975, which you've got William Shatner, Ernest Borgnine, and Ida Lupino, and John Travolta's in that as well. I think in a role.
Recognize him. As soon as he shows up, he has no lines. That you go, oh, that's John Travolta.
Yeah, I mean, but he also did. I mean, he also did a very good film called And Soon the Darkness, which is a kind of. I guess you would call it like horror, but it's more, I guess, a more psychological thriller about these two sort of teenagers who go cycling in the French countryside, and one of them goes missing, and so the other one is looking for her friend, and it's a very it just has that sort of slow creep an atmosphere. It has a very good atmosphere of slow creeping dread, and you kind of feel the isolation of this character, because, you know, she's English, she's in the French, so she's got the sort of language barrier, you know, this sort of world before mobile phones, so she's got no sort of way of like bringing in like other people in order to try and sort of help her at this moment. And that's a good little, if you're interested in this guy's other stuff, that would be definitely a film that I would recommend, you know, if you want to check out some more Robert Fust stuff.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. And Pamela Franklin's in it. She's one of those actors from the 70s that I remember, a British actress who, she's kind of a, what would you call it, an it girl of British cinema in the 70s. Well, good deal. I'm going to finish off the week in our show today with the Mel Gibson movie Payback, which, interestingly enough, was released twice. Once in a form where Gibson had taken over the film as producer, and that was the original release. And then 6 years later, the film was released on home video in its original, well, it's close to its original form, by Brian Hegland, who was the director and writer of the film. The film basically got taken away from him on the first go-round because the movie involved some elements that they didn't think were going to be appealing to the audience, and they were afraid it was going to limit its box office. Anybody familiar with Payback knows that it's basically a remake of Point Blank, the great Lee Marvin film from the 1960s, and the character of Parker is an implacable criminal who is out to get payback on the people who betrayed him and get the money back that he feels he earned by participating in a crime. And it involves going up against mobsters and you know, some great character actors. The original version that was released originally has William Devane in it and James Coburn, and then Kris Kristofferson, who was added as the villain when they took the film away. So they basically, it's like the last third of the movie was redone with Kris Kristofferson as the main villain that is the target of Gibson's Parker character. And I think that the story there is very good. It's been a while since I saw the Brian Hegland version of this movie, but I do know that they took out the narration that pops up every once in a while. They have a much more ambiguous ending about the film, and you don't even see the main head of the organization that is, that Parker's going after. So there are some differences. I think it's worth exploring those. If I had had time, because I just watched this, I don't know, Friday, and I didn't have time to watch the second version. That's the only one I have. I watched the Mel Gibson produced original release on Amazon, I think it was, and the one that I own is actually the Brian Hegland version, and I just didn't get a chance to plug it in for comparison purposes, but I do remember that there were some pretty substantial differences, especially in the last act. Anybody else catch this?
I have seen this, although I'm not, I don't remember it in particular detail, so I'm not, I don't remember which version I would have seen. I would have seen this on TV, so I don't know I don't know whether the director's cut version has usurped the sort of previous edits, or whether it's just the kind of theatrical one is the one that sort of, you know, is the one that is typically available for streaming. So I was completely unaware that there was this alternate version of this this film, and I'm anxious actually to sort of see the director's cut, which is assuming that's the version I haven't seen, because I really enjoy my crime fiction, and I'm a big I do have a big fan of Richard Stark, aka Donald E. Westlake, who is the author who wrote the Parker novels on which this film is based. So you have intrigued me with mention of these alternate cuts, Richard. I'm gonna have to go and investigate.
Well, good. A little investigation is a good idea. I hope we can see both of them and do the comparison. After I get done catching up with The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp and Private Property, I'm going to be looking for I'm going to dig out my copy of the Brian Hegland version of this so I can do the comparison, because I remember liking both of them quite well. And I did enjoy watching the one that was controlled by Mel Gibson and has the Kris Kristofferson character in the last hit. I thought that was perfectly fine, and I remember seeing it in theaters and enjoying it at the time. It was 1999, so it's not a knock on either version, just something that you can maybe explore when you guys have the time. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break here and come back for our exit question of the week. And while we're doing that, we're going to hear from a fellow Lem Podcasting Network show.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
We're back, and it's time for our exit question of the week. And because our film discussion this week involved what you've been watching, my question really focuses around why you've been watching. What is it that makes you choose a movie to watch in the first place? Are you a genre person who picks films that fit into a particular genre, like exploding helicopters? Are you into directors? You've got to see every movie that was directed by Martin Scorsese. Or are you one of those people who just is attracted by the star? You're a completist. Like if you're on the Strother Martin Film Project, you got to catch up with whatever film Strother Martin appeared in, and I got to make sure that I've got that covered. What draws you to a movie? So we're going to go back to our original list in order and ask the questions of the same people that we've been talking with. Nicole, how do you choose what movies to watch?
Well, Richard, I like my movies like I like my music, buffet style. So I'm pretty open to most directors, stars, and genres, with the exception of horror movies. I tend to be more picky when it comes to horror based on how scary the trailer looks, or how creepy the description of the movie reads. But mostly I gravitate towards action movies. So I take exploding helicopters. But growing up, I had a little rule where if I was going to the movie theaters or watching something on TV, since I've always liked Bruce Willis, my rule was if someone recommended a movie to me, I would ask, is Bruce Willis in it and is he jumping off of moving cars? Because if it isn't, I like an action hero movie. And so those were my requirements. And if both of them are present, then I'm all there. But at least one of them has to be present. But since Bruce, you know, he isn't doing movies anymore, I like most genres. But action is something where, outside of Transformers, maybe, the action movie genre is something where, like, I'm more likely to watch it even if it's dumb. Or, like, even if it's a bad movie, if, you know, someone's jumping off of a car or, like, climbing between moving buildings or something, or anything's exploding.
I like your criteria. I like your criteria. Years ago, look, I may have mentioned it before, I was a community college instructor, and I taught argumentation classes at university, and I had a section where we talked about arguing values, and a lot of, you know, movies, you're talking about what makes something good. And I asked people in class, you know, what makes a movie good? And I had somebody who gave the clearest answer ever. They said, Bruce Willis and guns.
Yes.
To them, it's a good movie if it has Bruce Willis and guns in it. If it has Bruce Willis without a gun, not necessarily a good movie. If it's got a gun and it's not Bruce Willis, not necessarily a good movie. But if you got the two of them together, then the movie's good. At least he had a very clear criteria, and I'm glad that you do as well. Nick, how do you choose the films that you watch?
It's called the psychotic method. It's truly sometimes I flip a coin. Sometimes it's someone tells me I should see it and I watch it. Sometimes it's based on my mood. Sometimes it's based on my feeling. It's really anything. It could be, hey, I haven't watched a science fiction film in 3 months. Let me go watch something science fiction. It could be, I've only got two films here. I'll flip a coin, and then whatever it lands on, that's what I'm watching tonight. And sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. There's just so much content out there anymore that I feel like I don't really have the time to be kind of picky and choosy anymore. I know what actors I like. I know what directors I like. I even know, you know, particular cinematographers I might like. So if I want something more of a visual treat, I know what to look for. But anymore, I'm just like, all right, I guess this will do. And then I go for it. And like I said, sometimes there's great success. Other times, ooh, not so much. But every so often, the universe will sync up and I'll see something. And then someone else I know have seen it the exact same day and we can talk about it, or, you know, just fun happenstances like that. But the other reason would be for a podcast as well. So that's mainly what it has been lately is, oh, there's a podcast about a movie. Let me watch this movie so I know what I'm talking about.
So what you're saying is it's a homework assignment.
Sometimes. Some films feel that way. There's some podcasts where I really got to just, you know, take a deep breath and count to 10 and then just power through it. And there's other ones where I'm like genuinely excited to tackle.
Good deal. All right, Will, I know what motivates you sometimes. other than the genre that you're operating in, do you have a reason for picking films?
I do, and it's, you know what, You know what, Richard, it's all of the things that you mentioned. So sometimes it's a director, sometimes it's an actor, sometimes it's a genre. So, you know, in there are directors I'm interested in. So, you know, at the moment I'm trying to work my way through Alfred Hitchcock's sort of filmography. There are actors who I enjoy watching. I mean, you like watching Warren Oates movies. I mean, I'm trying to work my way through Michael Caine's filmography at the moment. I'm nearly up to seeing 100 films of his. I mean, then there are genres that I'm interested in. So I'm a big fan of the film noir genre. So I'm trying to watch all of the films that have been reviewed in kind of the film noir encyclopedia written by Alan Silver and Elizabeth Ward. I'm trying to sort of watch all of the 300 or something films that are mentioned in there. But you know, a lot of the time actually it's mood that is the thing that governs what film I watch. And you know, somebody, you know, goes out to work, you know, a lot of the time I'm afraid I do end up, you know, getting home, have something to eat, and then, you know, it does tend to be something that is perhaps a bit more undemanding that I need, because I just haven't got the sort of the mental bandwidth to take something on. But you know, maybe at the weekend when I'm feeling a bit more rested, then I might tackle that sort of wrenching emotional drama that's been lurking on my my kind of sort of digital recorder at home, or I might tackle something with subtitles, just because you need to sort of, you know, if you're going to be reading the dialogue, you need to concentrate in a way in which you know, you don't necessarily have to do if everyone's speaking in English. So yeah, it's all of the things that you mentioned, and then I guess mood is the other thing that really factors into determining the films that I watch.
I like that phrase that you use, you know, the mental bandwidth that you don't have for some films. I understand that one completely. Howard, how about you?
It's a little hard to say. I think I'm like a lot of people. It really varies. I tend to be an art house person. So if something is doing well at festivals, or if it appears on Criterion, I'll want to watch it. As someone says, they know the directors they like, etc. So I'll watch a director until he's not good anymore. But then I try to be on the lookout for the new directors, and sometimes I feel like I'm not able to keep up. There are a few actors, sometimes it's the actors. I'll watch any Joaquin Phoenix film, I'll watch any Isabelle Huppert film, but there aren't very many actors that will get me in the seats. I'll be going on YouTube and they might have something come up that's really interesting. I'm also a big film noir fan, so you find all sorts of things on there. And the one thing about Criterion is they're both highbrow and lowbrow. So for example, this week they have movies about cats, and not the musical, but movies in which a cat plays some sort of central part to it. And most of them are just okay, or they're fun, or everything like that. But it's this, you know, they've got this thing on cats. So I'll try and watch a lot of those. Other times it's very prestigious directors. And I say, oh, I still need to catch up on some films with that person. I run out of time. And sometimes if someone comes up, like Ozu came up recently, and I was only able to see one film that I hadn't seen before. But it is kind of esoteric how it works, especially for new films. I think I did not want to see Spider-Man Across the I think Into the Spider-Verse, the first one, as I said, because I'd seen Spider-Man cartoons growing up. So I said, oh, I don't want to watch a Spider-Man cartoon. They're terrible. Then all of a sudden it starts winning awards and everybody on Facebook is saying how wonderful it is. So I went and saw it and it's great. The same for Godzilla. I was going to see Godzilla until everybody on Facebook started saying, you've got to see Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And I go see it finally. And it's one of the best films of the year. So it's sort of catch-as-catch-can sort of all around.
Word of mouth sometimes makes a big difference too. I know exactly what you mean because I'm influenced that way too. I'm afraid I'm like a puppy dog. I keep wandering around the films and suddenly I get a scent and I just follow it. if I turn on TCM, I'll just watch whatever's on TCM then, and then if I, you know, I'll notice an actor in that, and I say, oh, I like those kind of, I like the movies with this actor in it, and I'll look for something that that person's in. Or the example of the movie that I talked about today, Airplane. I watched Airplane because I read the book. I just finished a book about, it's called, let me see, Masterpiece in Disarray. It's about the making of David Lynch's Dune. And I was probably planning on watching Dune again, the David Lynch version, before the second chapter of Denis Villeneuve's film comes out. But that'll be something that I watch because that's just what I'm tracking that week. It's like this show. Somebody will mention something on the show, and I'll go, okay, that sounds interesting, and I'll follow through on that. So I feel I'm a little bit like ADD. Something comes up, and I'm going to follow up on that. There are occasionally actors that I'm always going to see in films. I'm probably a relative completist on Clint Eastwood. I like revenge films immensely, so if there's a revenge element to the film, I'll go and see that. So genres like that will probably pull me in. But I don't automatically see every horror film. I don't automatically see every action film. I like cars, but I'm not really a big fan of car films. I'm just a kid in the candy store looking at whatever's shiny and bright in front of me and letting that draw me in. And I'm happy when people on shows like this, wave something flashing in front of my face and say, "Ooh, look at this! Come see this." then I'm probably going to do that. So that's how I make the choices. Well, I'm going to give everybody a chance. First of all, I want to thank you all for joining me this week. It's always fun to have people on who are excited about whatever it is they're watching and are willing to share it. If you got something to promote, this is going to be the time. So, Howard, I know that you've got your site to promote. Is there something that you want us to turn our eyes and ears to?
Well, I finally put up the Parasite La Cérémonie on Pop Art, the discussion of those two films, where not only can it's hard to find good help, it can be actually deadly. And coming up are three, The Verne, where we have recorded it, May, December, A Dream of Passion, about actors looking, go to people whose roles resemble these people, and they're doing it to get inspiration or figure out how to play the role. Tob Liebenow, we're recording this week on the Fantastic Mixture Fox and Straight Time about ex-cons trying to go straight but can't. And then Richard, you're up next, where we're doing Ghost and Truly, Madly, Deeply, where people come back to haunt their loved ones, whether you want them to or not. After that, I'm going to New Zealand for a cruise, so I'm not exactly sure when the next one is going to be.
Excellent.
Take me!
All right. Nicole, what have you got to promote this week?
Not much. Everybody can find me on Twitter at MATLABPost or at my site. I am considering adapting a television show that I have that airs here in Philly into written blog posts and like 5-minute clips based on one segment of the show, where I go through the filmography, the short film filmography of different actors and or directors. So I'm thinking about doing that. So far, I think I covered Keanu Reeves, Emily Blunt, Michael Rapaport, and Robert Downey Jr. I didn't put that on the show, but I have the script. And so I was thinking, well, I already made this content. I might as well just adapt the script into like a blog post in a 5-minute like YouTube video or something.
I think 5 minutes is very reasonable for people to check in on. I know that I told you I thought it was going to be a short show today. You may refer to me as the incredibly optimistic time estimator. yeah, you know, anything that's relatively brief, I think everybody can give some attention to. I think that's worth following up on. Will, what's coming up?
Well, I've got a new episode of the Explaining Helicopter podcast landing in the forthcoming week. I'm going to be reviewing a French submarine thriller called The Wolf's Call, which, despite all its aquatic action, also includes an exploding helicopter. And going to be reviewing that film with Nick, who is on this podcast with us. And then, yeah, if you're interested in finding out about more, if you want to sort of see or find out more information about films where helicopters explode, you can go over to our website, explodinghelicopters.com, where I've got, yeah, reviews and information about strange ways helicopters keep blowing up in movies. And yeah, if you are interested in any of that, then you can follow us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, and on Twitter as well, under the handle @chopperfireball.
All right, all you Chopper Fireball fans, you know, make sure that you catch up with the latest episode, because Nick is on it. Nick, do you have other things that you're promoting too?
I do have other things that I'm promoting too. If you head over to rabbitholepodcasts.com, you'll find a myriad of podcasts. I am on two of them. One of them, Lyrical Innuendo, Bubba Wheat, and myself. Each week, we take a look at a song and we look at its lyrics and listen to it, and we determine if it's about sex, drugs, or just good old fashioned rock and roll. And another show that's been challenging lately, but in a good way, Play MST for me. Richard, it's funny you mentioned Mystery Science Theater 3000 earlier. Jason Soto is taking me on an adventure. We're watching every single episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 from the beginning, as he is a super mega fan, and I've never seen an episode, although that has been changing as I've now seen 11 episodes. Go give that show a listen. It's a whole lot of fun, and it's pretty wacky at times.
Okay. You know, I remember listening to a few of those shows that Jason did on Mystery Science Theater when he had another podcast years ago. I'm like you. I've never seen an episode of Mystery Science Theater, so I guess maybe this is the way for me to immerse myself in that world, checking in on your podcast.
Yeah, because the normal thing would just be like, hey, show me some favorite episodes of yours, and not, hey, let's watch every episode from the beginning.
That's a big commitment to make, you know. I hope that you have the time to do that.
I have to set years aside.
You know, I have the usual thing to promote on my websites, but I especially want to promote on the LAM site the vote for the February Movie of the Month. It happens that February is my birth month, and I'm continuing the tradition that was started by my predecessor. All the movies that are up for Movie of the Month this month in February were suggested by me. So there are 7 films up there that are available for you to vote for. They're all blind spots for me. They're films that I have not seen, and I'm interested in any of them. So if you folks want to have some influence on what we're talking about next month, you can go to the LAM site and pick one of those 7 films to vote for and have your 2 cents heard, because I don't know what's going to be the film yet. Voting for it closes on February 11th, so you still have a couple of weeks to get in on this content and participate in the process, even if you don't join the show. And by the way, we're happy to have people join the show. If anybody's interested, by the way, in next week's show, Argyle, I have spots. Right now, it's just me and Lisa Leahy. So I'm perfectly willing to take volunteers. Contact me at the LAM site or lamcast.com or at kirkham007@gmail.com, because I could use a little bit more participation on that particular show. I think it's going to be a great movie. I hope it will be. I'm a big fan of Matthew Vaughn. All right, I'm going to thank everybody for joining us again this week one more time. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to several of the films that people have recommended. I don't know that I'll ever get to some of them, but I do know that there are 2 or 3 of them that I have to do now, dang it, you know, which is exactly what I need. More movies in my life, and I hope that's the way everybody else feels too. More movies in our lives, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right.
All right, folks, thank you, and we'll catch you next time here on the LAMcast.
listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Sheep go to heaven. Goats go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for, like, no reason.